Every once in a while, I do a sermon on a dare. Not a dare from someone else, but from myself to myself. I dare myself to offer a sermon on a subject I know very little about, with very little idea where I would go with it. And that, dear friends and congregants, is what you're getting today. As good and productive as our strategic planning workshops have been over this fall, two Saturdays over the last three, and I had originally thought about the idea of doing a sermon that would take off from that, I decided that as good as they were not the stuff of sermons, and that I would have to put that off for some other time. And since I am, after all, a bit of cider when it comes to sermon topics, I decided to go in another direction this morning. Intermingled with all the electioneering now taking place in this seemingly endless presidential campaign that is thankfully and mercifully approaching its end, has been, and if you had to be on another planet not to notice this, has been all the news of financial turmoil, great financial uncertainty, complete with failing banks, tightening credit lines, $700 billion in federal money being approved by a very reluctant Congress in an attempt to bring some stabilization to an increasingly unstable set of circumstances, both here in the United States and now, by all indications, moving around the world. This past week, a CNN poll revealed that 60% of Americans believe that another Great Depression is likely. However reality-based such fears may be, this is truly a case where perception takes on a reality of its own. And the reason this is a dare sermon is because I am right there. I'm right on the same page with Senator McCain when he said, "I don't know very much about economics." Of course, I'm not running for president, but we can set that aside. And really, honest to goodness, I wouldn't know these spready and fanny people if they came walking through the door back there. So I don't know much about economics. I somehow made it all through college without even taking a single econ course, as a matter of fact. What I can confess to is some anxiety right now about looking at the current state of my pension plan. But I do know something about fear and uncertainty and what these things can do to the mind and spirit of human beings. I can say a bit about that, as I will a little later in these remarks. But first, I have to share with you a scene from a movie that flashed through my mind as I was trying to get my head around this topic. Some of you may have seen it. It's the 1961 version of the film Splendor in the Grass, which is kind of on my all-time favorites list. The musical score for this film was composed by my friend David Amram. David did me the honor a few years ago of writing a foreword to one of my books, so perhaps I'm a little biased about the whole thing. I have not seen the 1981 remake. I'm sticking strictly with the original version here. Set this up. The film is set in a small Kansas town in the late 1920s. Natalie Wood and Warren Beatty play a couple of high school seniors, Deanie Lumis and Bud Stamper, who are in the throes of teenage love and in the throes of struggling with their intense late adolescent sexuality. In fact, sexual repression against the backdrop of small-town America in 1927-28 is sort of the major overarching theme or plot in this film. Now, there's also a subplot. As I say, the major plot is about the seductiveness and precariousness and delight danger of sex, all of which lands Natalie Wood's Dean Loomis in a mental hospital for a time after she makes a suicide attempt. But the subplot is about the seductiveness and precariousness, and the light danger of wealth. And these two themes, if you've seen the movie, they kind of do a dance throughout that film. Well, if you're looking for me to run with the sex theme, sorry about that. I'm running with the subplot wealth theme instead. This business of daring myself only goes up to a point. Well, Bud Stamper, father's name is Ace Stamper. He's the richest man in town, if not in the entire state of Kansas. He's a self-made millionaire who's put his money in the stock market, which in the booming and roaring 1920s is making him richer by the day. And so he goes out to acquire for himself all the trappings of wealth. One of those trappings involves him basically buying his son's way into Yale University, even though Bud has neither the academic qualifications nor the desire to go there. One of the scenes in this film that has stayed with me takes place, perhaps not surprisingly, in a church. The Stampers, their wealth notwithstanding, still need to keep up social appearances. And one way that was done, particularly in small-town 1920s Midwest America, was to go to church, especially one of the local Protestant churches. And so the scene is a Sunday morning service with the Stampers, the Loomises, and a lot of other town folk in attendance. And the minister speaks from a passage in the Gospel of Matthew where Jesus says, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and decay destroy." And he goes on from there to talk about the perils of becoming unduly reliant upon earthly wealth and earthly goods, upon the need to keep one's mind and spirit focused on higher things and such as that, in the way you would expect a minister to go, playing off of that passage. In the midst of the sermon, a Stamper falls asleep. And there's this great juxtaposition in this scene where the minister is speaking about the capriciousness of earthly wealth, and the counterpoint are the snoring sounds of the richest man in Kansas in the background. And it kind of goes back and forth like that throughout this scene. Now, the minister looks clearly out of touch up there in his pulpit. Many of the other townspeople are also doing quite well for themselves, whether it's directly due to the Stamper fortune or just the booming economy of the 1920s. Everybody else in the congregation, at least, is still polite enough to not go to sleep, but his sermon is having about as much effect upon them as it is upon Mr. Stamper. Okay, if you've seen this film, you know how it plays out. Bud goes off to Yale, where he proceeds to fail all of his courses. The stock market crashes. Ace Stamper jumps to his death out of a New York City hotel window, where he has gone in a failed attempt to save his fortune. Bud marries a waitress from New Haven. They go back to Kansas to be chicken farmers on the last little bit of property that's left in the Stamper family. In the final scene, Natalie Wood as Dini Loomis pays Warren Beatty as Bud Stamper one last visit out of his hardscrabble farm. She tells him that she will soon be getting married herself and that their lives must go on. You know, and I'm not a guy who cries at movies, but that last scene always does kind of puts a lump in my throat anyway. And I only learned this when I went back to research this film this past week. Its screenwriter was William Inge, very good playwright in his own right. And Mr. Inge was given the opportunity to play a bit part in this movie, kind of as a way of putting his signature on it, the way Alfred Hitchcock did in his movies as well. And Mr. Inge chose to play the part of the minister in the scene I have described. The scene itself lasts for maybe a minute. But the minister is the movie's truth teller. And I guess that was the point the screenwriter wanted to make by taking on that part for himself. But then I replayed this film in my head this past week, thinking about that church scene. And then I thought, well, I wonder what, you know, the movie ends with the way I described it. You don't see the minister anymore. I wonder what William Inge's minister said to his congregation after the fall. What did he say to his congregation after his point about the capriciousness and seductiveness of earthly treasure had been proven in some very cruel and harsh ways? Well, that's my point of departure for the rest of the time I'm going to go here as I try to pull my thoughts together on this very crucial matter. We're not in a depression. 60% of our citizenry, however, if that CNN poll is accurate, think we're headed for one. I'm not going to prognosticate on that because you know the sort of the standard line on that anyway. If your neighbor loses his or her job, it's a recession. If you lose yours, it's a depression. Doesn't really matter what you call it. The sense of anxiety and uncertainty that this financial crisis has quite understandably generated is clearly amongst us, whatever label we may be putting on it. Back up a little bit. One of my colleagues in the UU ministry, the Reverend Galen Gingrich at the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City, spoke to this same topic this past Sunday. Galen did not open with Splendor in the Grass, but he cited a passage from a book by Jonathan Sacks, who is the chief rabbi of Great Britain. And I think it's worth passing along. Rabbi Sacks' book is titled The Dignity of Difference. The passage is a bit long, so bear with me as I read it. Economic superpowers, seemingly invincible in their time, have a relatively short lifespan. Venice in the 16th century, the Netherlands in the 17th, France in the 18th, Britain in the 19th, and the United States in the 20th. The great religions, by contrast, survive. Islam is 1,500 years old, Christianity 2,000, and Judaism 4,000. Why this should be is open to debate. My own view is that world faiths embody truths unavailable to economics and politics, and they remain salient even when everything else changes. They remind us that civilizations survive not by strength, but by how they respond to the weak. Not by wealth, but the care they show for the poor. Not by power, but by their concern for the powerless. The ironic, yet utterly humane lesson of history is that what renders a civilization invulnerable is the compassion it shows to the vulnerable. The ultimate value we should be concerned is to maximize human dignity. The dignity of all human beings equally as children of the creative, redeeming God. Well, you don't have to be completely simpatico with the rabbi's theology to appreciate his larger point, which is that there are certain truths and values that actually have greater staying power than those of economic might, which various civilizations and nations have achieved over the course of human history. Well, I'm going to assume that we can accept Rabbi Sacks' contention that the ultimate human value is the maximizing of human dignity, because he is simply restating, after all, from his tradition, our first Unitarian Universalist principle that says we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. So where might this principle take us at the present moment? I'm going to speak to that briefly at our societal and national level, and then I'm going to bring it to what I see it meaning for those of us in this, members and friends of this congregation. 3 weeks from today, on November the 2nd, I will offer my pre-election sermon. So this is going to be a quick touchdown this morning. To be sure, we need leaders in positions of political power with the wisdom, the skill, and the courage to confront the financial crisis we are in and push for solutions that will alleviate it, as painful and costly as some of those solutions may be. And I am listening very carefully to the solutions that are being proposed and advocated. But I'm listening for something more as well. I am listening for some articulation, some concept, some vision of the common good in the midst of these very uncommon times. I am looking for those who will lead us to show us a path towards the more perfect union our founders called for, even as we face some of the most serious and costly imperfections that have come our way over the course of our nation's history. I am looking for leadership that will acknowledge that we are living in fearful and uncertain times while not being driven by that fear and uncertainty. And of course, I am concerned for my personal well-being as well as that of my family, just as I know each and all of you are. But I'm also trying not to lose sight of the fact that I'm part of a larger community, this community here, a national community, a global community. And I'm looking for leadership that can keep all of us mindful of that, even in the midst of whatever personal crises and uncertainties we may be dealing with. I am looking for leadership that shows at least some level of awareness of Rabbi Sacks' reminder that civilizations survive not by strength, but by how they respond to the weak. Enough on that for now. I'll revisit it in 3 weeks. Because I also want to turn our attention to this congregation, to this community that means so much to so many of us. For whatever kind of leadership we may get in the political and financial arenas, we have our own calling to be faithful to. If, as Rabbi Sacks suggests, it is world faiths that, quoting him, embody truths unavailable to economics and politics, then let us continue to embody the truths that we hold dear. Let us continue to seek the ways of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, as another of our principles call for. Let us continue, as we have this morning to extend a portion of our resources to those whom Jesus and the prophets called the least of these. And let us as well make our human resources that are here in this congregation, let's make sure we make them available to ourselves, to one another. For the fear and uncertainty of which I have been speaking is not by any means all out there somewhere. Some of you, perhaps many of you, know what I speak about firsthand. You have your own concerns, your own anxieties, your own uncertainties to deal with, especially in the light of recent weeks. And I know the natural human reflex to feelings of fear and uncertainty is to kind of pull back into oneself. I know that's generally the first place I go when I find I don't quite know where I'm going. I go back inside. And I understand the need to stay curled up inside when that feels like it's the only safe place to be. The only thing I can say is don't stay there any longer than you actually need to. You have a home here. And I hope you'll seek care and support from those whom you've come to know and trust in this home, and offer care and support to others in return whenever and wherever such is needed. Yes, I know, we have a house and a home to care for and to be nurtured here. In this place we call the Unitarian Universalist Church of Nashua, we will face our challenges, I'm sure, in the months ahead. And yet I have every confidence that we can and will meet those challenges in the days to come. As Laurie's already mentioned, as I said myself, some of us spent the past couple of Saturdays, or two out of the last three Saturdays, helping to chart a course for ourselves and the congregation in the years ahead. It's going to take renewed commitment and dedication to get us there. And I believe we have what it takes. I'm going to close with one more revisit of that movie I put before you earlier. Because in the second part in that passage, the minister cites, after he gets off the line about lay not up for yourselves treasure on earth where moth and decay destroy, he goes on in the same verse, he says, but store up treasures in heaven where neither moth nor decay. Now, on a literal level, of course, the idea of treasures in heaven sounds pretty quaint and irrelevant, especially if the physical locale of a place called heaven doesn't quite make it onto your radar screen. But the larger point being made here, if you can get past the first century terminology that it's couched in, is just simply that there are more important things to be gained in our earthly lives than whatever earthly treasures we're able to acquire, as valuable and necessary as those earthly treasures of yours and mine are and may be. So my one hope for all of us is that this house and this home will be a place for us where we will truly seek and find that which is eternal and lasting in our lives, and where we will continue to share our findings and our lives and our support and our care with one another as our journeys meaning and spirit continue. With this in mind, let's sing together our closing hymn. It's number 1.